Hello, I'm Ros Atkins. It's 17 hours GMT and time for the BBC's World Have Your Say.
I heard the loud sound of a blast. I was sitting at the time, and most of those who were sitting around me were killed. Around 15 to 20 people were busy in prayer at that time. None of them survived.
In Lahore yesterday, over 40 people lost their lives in two suicide bombings. Today, in the north of Afghanistan, five more died when six suicide bombers attacked a US aid organization. And in the past decade, thousands of people have been killed by individuals prepared to give their life and take others for the cause that they believe in. And over the next hour, we're going to discuss what, if anything, can be done to stop the suicide bomber. We'll hear from people with solutions and those who say that nothing can work.
BBC News with Marianne Marshall. The former head of police in South Africa, Jackie Salibi, has been found guilty of corruption. Mr. Salibi, who is also a former head of Interpol, is one of the most senior officials to be tried for corruption in South Africa. Karen Allen reports from Johannesburg.
No comment.
Leaving court with a throng of press trailing behind him, Jackie Salibi, the former chief of police, gave no reaction to the verdict. He'd accepted gifts worth up to $150,000 from a convicted drugs baron, Glenn Agliotti, in return for turning a blind eye to his drug deals. And although Mr. Salibi pleaded his innocence, claiming he was a victim of a conspiracy, in the words of Judge Mayor Joffe, Mr. Salibi knew there was no such thing as a free lunch.
The new American commander of NATO-led forces in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus, has arrived in the country, hours after suicide attackers stormed a US aid compound in the northern city of Kunduz, killing at least four people. General Petraeus was appointed after his predecessor, Stanley McChrystal, was sacked for making disparaging remarks about senior American officials. From Kabul, Quentin Somerville reports.
General Petraeus arrived at Kabul airport at 6:30 in the evening and transferred immediately by helicopter to the International Security and Assistance Force headquarters. An assumption of command ceremony will take place this weekend, but he's already started work as the top US and NATO commander here in Afghanistan. He's expected to meet President Karzai in the coming days. The general, who replaces the sacked Stanley McChrystal, arrives at a time when the war's progress is being called into question. Suicide killings in Afghanistan are at a record high. There are three a week. And the general admits that despite 9 years of fighting, the Taliban are confident and resilient.
The human rights group Amnesty International has challenged the official Chinese version of events in Xinjiang a year ago when nearly 200 people were killed in the regional capital, Urumqi. At the time, China blamed the violence on the ethnic Uyghur population. Here's Andre Vornik.
Almost a year on from the bloodshed in Urumqi, Amnesty quotes eyewitnesses as saying demonstrators were attacked by the security forces, shot in the back or denied protection. It speaks of disappearances, torture and ill treatments. China argues Uyghur separatists were chiefly to blame. Most of the recorded victims were Han Chinese. The leadership views Xinjiang, which is largely Muslim, as a key security concern. In the run-up to the anniversary of the violence on Monday, tens of thousands of security cameras have been installed in Urumqi to deter any sign of public dissent.
Gunmen in Colombia have attacked a nightclub outside the city of Medellin, killing at least seven people. Police said the attackers opened fire indiscriminately with machine guns before escaping on motorbikes. Officials suspect the killings were related to a dispute between rival cocaine trafficking gangs. Medellin has seen a surge in drug-related killings in recent months. World news from the BBC. The level of unemployment in the United States fell in June to 9.5%, the lowest figure in almost a year. This was despite the economy shedding 125,000 jobs during the same month. Analysts said there'd been a drop in the number of Americans actively looking for work and therefore counted as unemployed. The jobs market itself remained weak. A new constitution has taken effect in Kyrgyzstan, following its approval in a referendum on Sunday. It brings in a parliamentary system of government ahead of elections in October and cuts the power of the president. Kyrgyzstan's interim leader, Rosa Otunbayeva, who took power in an uprising in April, is confirmed as president until 2011. Brazil have been knocked out of the World Cup. The Netherlands won their quarter-final match, beating the Brazilians by 2-1. Shortly, Ghana will try to make history by becoming the first African country to reach a World Cup semi-final when they take on Uruguay. Alex Capstick reports from Johannesburg.
The most successful country in World Cup history has been eliminated at the quarter-final stage for the second successive tournament. In Brazil, this will be treated as a national tragedy. It was a feisty encounter. Brazil had a man sent off. By then, they were in the unfamiliar position of trailing by 2-1. They couldn't recover. The Netherlands have maintained their 100% record at this World Cup. Their place in the semi-finals might be viewed as a surprise, but the Dutch are now serious contenders for the title.
The acclaimed English novelist Beryl Bainbridge has died of cancer at the age of 75. She won many awards for contemporary fiction, including the Whitbread Award for her novel Injury Time. Her bestseller, An Awfully Big Adventure, which delves into the emotional intrigues of a theatre company in Liverpool, was made into a film. Her literary agent Ed Wilson said she'd been finishing a novel when she died, and he plans to publish it next year. BBC News.
We've had the news from the BBC. Now it's our turn. Call us on country code 44 20 70 83 72 72. Welcome to World Have Your Say.
Hello, I'm Ros Atkins. Thanks for joining us today. Yesterday, suicide bombers killed at least 42 people in Lahore. Meanwhile, five people today were killed by suicide bombers attacking the office of a US development organization in Afghanistan. Both cases again highlight the difficulties in stopping an attack carried out by someone who's prepared to die. But stopping these bombings are the unwanted challenge that Israel, the UK, Sri Lanka, Iraq, Russia, Pakistan and Afghanistan, to name just seven, have had to face over the past few years. So what, if anything, can be done? Are there military and policing solutions? Is it necessary to remove the reasons someone's prepared to give their life? Or does long-term social change need to occur so that there's no support, even among small minorities, for such drastic and devastating action? We also know that some of you feel nothing can really be done. Your comments and your questions are welcome.
Phone country code 44 20 70 83 72 72.
Email what have you say at bbc.co.uk.
With us during the programme are going to be Paul Rogers from the University of Bradford, Asad Jirani, former head of the Inter-Services Intelligence in Pakistan, also a retired general from the Pakistani Army, now a defence analyst. And we have Shankar Vedantam, a reporter at the Washington Post. And we'll hear from all three of them in a moment. But let's bring in two people on the phone, one in Pakistan, one in Afghanistan, and then we'll hear our guests respond to what they have to say. Khadija, you're in Lahori Pindi in Pakistan. Another attack yesterday has killed over 40 people. Do you believe there are ways of stopping these things happening?
Well, first and foremost, we have to identify the issues. The factors leading such people to kill themselves and kill so many people in the process. Unfortunately, we cannot just point at one factor and say that, oh, it is Islamic radicalism or Islamic extremism or poverty, for that matter, that causes people to kill themselves and kill people in the process. It is actually a combination of factors that leads to such. For example, just now I was watching on the internet a documentary by Shermin, who went to Sawat and interviewed these kids. And what the first step that the Taliban do is that they isolate these kids from their families. So when these kids do not know people who love, who care, who nurture them, change their perspective. They change the way they look at the world. And it is such factors such as poverty, ignorance, maybe extremism, and isolation from family.
Khadija, let me just interrupt you a moment, just because I'm worried people might not be able to hear you well enough on the phone line. But you're saying that in some cases this is about long-term motivation, but in the Swat Valley in Pakistan, you think more often than not people are taken away from their families and have ideas put into their mind when they're disconnected from their family and friends. Asad Jirani, does that ring true with what you know, that actually these aren't long-term resentments, these are things which people are taught to feel?
Yes, I agree. There are a number of reasons why people can be motivated or are motivated to go and kill themselves. Primarily, when one looks at this phenomena, that in this particular war, we call it a symmetric war, but even in the conventional warfare, one finds that the use of suicide bombers is a very effective technique, because human being, after all, is the best weapon system that ever existed. And it has all those all those qualities that would pass it or that would qualify it to be an effective instrument of war.
And bearing that in mind, Paul Rogers at the University of Bradford, bearing in mind how effective it is, how should a country go about trying to defend itself against these kind of attacks?
Well, as Khadija said, there are many issues and motives and even aspects of training involved. Beyond that, there is the issue of the circumstances in which people even consider this in the first place. So in some ways, there are multiple approaches to trying to control it. You can try prevention, you can try protection of people who might otherwise be attacked. I think in the long run, you do have to dig deeper and look at the circumstances in which suicide or martyr bombing even becomes an option. And that varies in different parts of the world, in the different conflicts we've seen, not just over the last 20 or 30 years, but going right back to the Japanese 60 or so years ago. You have to get underneath what is happening and why there is even the possibility of people willing to give their own lives in the first place. So it's a complex thing, many different answers rather than one, because there are different motives and different circumstances involved.
Faridoon, you're in Kabul. Do you sometimes worry that suicide bombing will always be a part of your life in Afghanistan?
Well, I think I tend to agree to that. But first of all, I would like to shed light on why suicide bombings are happening. For instance, look at Taliban suicide bombers. They're coming from a society or a level of a society that are very poor, economically very deprived. And they are the people who belong to farmer families. How often do we hear that Qadir Hussein Ahmad's son has been a suicide bomber or any other high-profile mullah whose son has committed a suicide attack? Suicide attack itself, as it has been stated by the guest, Mr. Durrani, is a very effective and the cheapest weapon. Especially with poverty rising in Pakistan, you can find lots of people who can come forward and being brainwashed. It can be used as suicide attackers.
So that,
as long as being worried about the suicide attack being part of our life.
So, Faridoon, that's interesting. You make the connection with money on two fronts. You say that, A, the people who carry out these attacks often live in poverty, but you also highlight the fact that as a form of attack, it's cheap, which makes it attractive to organizations who maybe don't have as much funding as others. Shankar Vedantam, you're not just a reporter with the Washington Post. You've written the book, The Hidden Brain. You're live with us from Harvard University. Do you agree there's a link between suicide bombing and money?
Well, I think there certainly is a link in that it requires money to arm and train groups and to set up camps and do indoctrination and that kind of thing. But I disagree with Verdun from Kabul on the assumption that it's primarily the poor who are recruited to become suicide bombers. I think actually if you look at the empirical evidence, there is not very strong evidence that suicide terrorism is primarily caused by economic deprivation. And you can look at this in two ways. One, you can look at parts of the world that are very poor that do not produce suicide bombers and ask why that's the case. And secondly, you can look at the people who actually do become suicide bombers. And if you only look at the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks in the United States, you know, many of the ringleaders were professionals and have been professionals for subsequent attacks and attempted attacks.
Buritz in Uganda has got in touch with us from Facebook. I don't think there's any way to stop it. We just have to find a way to live with it, she says. Kerry's also getting in touch from the States. No, we won't be able to stop it until the bombers have something to live for beyond the empty promise of an afterlife. And here's an interesting point from Everton in the West Indies. Maybe all of you could pick up on this. He says, this is like asking, can the formation of storms and hurricanes in the Atlantic during the hurricane season be stopped? Taking one's life for a cause is the ultimate sacrifice. And it seems to me that anyone who will strap explosives to his or her body, knowing full well what the outcome will be, is clearly beyond any amount of reasoning that the world may want to employ. And lots of people have mentioned this, Paul, that the idea, the hope that you can persuade someone not to do this is based on the fact they're thinking clearly, and people are saying, well, they obviously aren't thinking clearly, otherwise they wouldn't be doing this or considering this in the first place.
I can see Everton's point. In some ways, the hurricane analogy is very good. You can't predict exactly how they will occur, but hurricanes come as a result of particular conditions, oceanic organic and climatic. And in the same way, you tend to find that suicide bombing comes from particular circumstances. One of the most significant examples is work which was done among the kamikaze pilots from Japan at the end of the Second World War. A few of them actually survived the attacks, and others were captured before they could stage the attacks. And what the people who really interrogated them found was that there was a mixture of three motives. One certainly was loyalty to the emperor. Another was the feeling that they were part of a group, an isolated group, and they did it not to let their fellows down. But very powerful motive was they thought they were doing it to protect their own country from the Americans, who they'd led to believe, if they had taken over Japan, would kill their families and bring utter destruction. So there was actually a mixture of motives there, but there was this underlying thing of doing something for their own community in given circumstances.
And Asad Durrani in Pakistan, can those three points that Paul makes about the kamikaze pilots, can we translate those into modern-day Pakistan?
Well, yes, we can. The only thing one has to do is find the right motivation. Some of our people would be moved to give up their life because of, let's say, the occupation of Afghanistan and whatever may be happening, Pakistan cooperating there, or the action that the Pakistan army takes in some parts of the country. Lal Masjid, for example, that famous episode where the army killed a number of women and children, mostly belonging to the tribal areas. Now, that was one reason for these people to also decide to go this particular path. Political, ideological, money can play a role in certain cases, or an additional role in certain cases. But basically, these are the reasons that people would do it. Look, the effectiveness of a suicide bomber. Once you have been motivated, and then you also understand that you can go down, in any case you might die, if not now, a few months or a few years later, mm-hmm. but in the process you're going to take down 20, 30 of the other side, the security forces, the Americans in Afghanistan, for example. So that becomes one good reason, and that's why I call it the most effective way of fighting, especially this asymmetric war, where the non-state actors do not have those resources that they can apply to, you know, reasonably have a chance, have an opportunity to give a good battle on the field.
Nick's in the States. He's just emailed worldhaveyousay@bbc.com. I'd like to believe we can make peace with those who wish us harm. If we can establish a relationship where each side can speak to each other at any time of the day or night, then maybe we can avoid future issues. I guess it's whether that kind of dialogue can be created, Nick. And Victor in Kenya is raising a point. Maybe, Shankar, you can pick up on this. He says, I think that the Muslim world should try harder to stop extremism by not glorifying the suicide bombers as martyrs. Do you think that would help stop them if they knew they would be looked down on rather than celebrated, even by a small minority?
I certainly think that suicide bombers sign up for missions, as Paul Rogers said, because they believe very intensely in the well-being of small groups. In almost every case in which suicide terrorism or suicide bombers have emerged over the last several decades, invariably it's emerged in the context of very small groups of people with intense loyalties to one another, where people feel their loyalty to the group comes before their loyalty even to themselves or to their own lives. And part of the way in which groups cement this kind of loyalty is indeed to immortalize people who have participated and carried out in these attacks. But I want to distinguish between the loyalty to the small group as opposed to the loyalty to the large group. I think the Muslim world is deeply divided on this issue, and as the recent attacks show, it's the Muslim world that has paid the biggest price in terms of suicide terrorism over the last several years. And so it's certainly not the case that large numbers of Muslims celebrate suicide terrorism or glorify the terrorists. The problem is that it doesn't require mass glorification to provide the motivation for these people to carry out these attacks, that the loyalties embedded with very small groups and the human tendency to value the opinions of the small groups that surround each and every one of us is the psychological underpinning for many of these attacks.
Shankar, you're a reporter with The Washington Post, also the author of the book The Hidden Brain. Our other main guests are Asad Durrani, former head of the Inter-Services Intelligence in Pakistan, also a retired general from the Pakistani Army. And Paul Rogers is with us from the University of Bradford. And if you're just joining us, we're discussing what, if anything, can be done to stop suicide bomb attacks. And we're joined by Daria. She's in Moscow. She got in touch with us through Facebook. And if any of you do stay in touch with us that way, if you ever want to just send us your phone number, we're happy to get you onto the program. Hi, Daria. Thanks for getting involved.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to say?
Well, I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of the program, but I could hear that some of the people were mentioning the religious aspect of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Though I think a lot of it has to do with the situation in which people live, and if they don't have enough, if they don't have enough food, money, and if their life is really hard, sometimes it's just desperation, and if some ideas are instilled in their minds, they just go and do something crazy like this.
I mean, Asad Jirani, in your experience, are suicide bombers in Pakistan from the poorer parts of society, or are they ideologically driven and come from all parts of society?
Mostly ideologically driven, but I think there is also a good point made by one of your guests. There is a social reason also when your individuals associate themselves or identify themselves with a group. For example, in the tribal areas, in the tribal societies, the first loyalty is to the tribe, then to the, you know, inheritance. And lastly, the individual, you know, considers himself expendable for the sake of the name of the society. So that is just one part. So primarily, the answer to your question is most of them have political or ideological reason, not religious in that sense, mm-hmm. because it reminds me, you know, in 97, when this thing, you know, this terrorism business did not have that type of hype, in one of the seminars, an Israeli was suggesting that he would try and get a fatwa from the Sunni ulamas because the Shias were the ones who were committing more suicides in Israeli-held Palestine, and there they may be able to overcome that. It apparently was futile, and whenever in Pakistan people have asked for a fatwa or a religious injunction, one can only say that maybe we haven't either understood this phenomena or haven't learned enough from other people's experience.
Lots of people are picking up on the issue of poverty. Samuel's just got in touch from Zambia saying, you will stop suicide bombing when you stop poverty and illiteracy, but Expat 73 has responded. Many of the 9/11 suicide bombers were intelligent individuals, some with undergraduate or advanced degrees. It can't all be down to poverty. And Daria, just quickly before you go, how do we explain the suicide bombings that have occurred in your country? Why do you think that's happened?
Yeah, I think it has to do with wars, with wars that are ignored or are not tackled. And the problem is, I think that a lot of people in my country are kind of deafened. I don't know, they're blind, and they think that wars are far away, and mm-hmm. this will not happen to them. So when it happens in the center of the city, everybody is shocked. And then the shock passes, and then they forget. And
so also, that's interesting, that maybe a lack of interest or a lack of focus is one of the reasons it's allowed to occur again and again, because people forget the seriousness of the threat. Daria, thank you very much for speaking to us, and we appreciate you getting involved online as well. Okay, we're going to take the conversation to Sri Lanka and also to Gaza now. We can speak to Dr. Ayad Al-Sarraj. He's a psychiatrist and director of Gaza's Community and Mental Health Program. Sir, thank you for joining us on the BBC.
My pleasure.
What do you think is the answer to stopping suicide bombing occurring in your part of the world?
Well, I think that I agree with most of the speakers who, of course, explained the reason and the motivation behind it. I think that you have to understand why people do this. I think basically it's a question of identity, it's a group identity, it's a question of ideology, it's a question of despair. It's an environmental despair in the sense that people are desperate to fight back a kind of aggression on them, and they cannot fight it back with a regular army or with tanks and with the F-16s. And so they volunteer their body, believing in their ideology that by giving themselves as martyrs, they actually are given a new life, and also a new life to their own country, to their own people, defending as the Japanese did and as the Palestinians did, and as so many people are doing it today against an overwhelming aggressive forces like the Americans or the mm-hmm. Israelis, the individual become himself a vehicle for the liberation. And this is why the whole community glorifies them, because these people are sacrificing themselves for the country. Without changing this disparity of power, this balance of power, this in despair and the environment in which people are grown up to be so desperate and so hopeless and so helpless, then, of course, this phenomena will continue to be with us. And as long as people in the United States of America believe that with overwhelming force they can control countries and destroy countries, they will always be met with individuals who are ready to defend their countries and be martyrs.
Okay, well, while we can leave aside the rights and wrongs of America's foreign policy and the behavior of Israel, I'm curious, Paul, to take this on a little bit further, because while I understand Dr. El-Sarraj's explanation of people feeling desperate and feeling like they're trapped and feeling like there's no way of getting justice, all of those emotions exist in parts of the world where we don't have suicide bombers. So how do we understand that?
I think where you get the suicide bombers, it is often where you have those circumstances, but they become more extreme because of events. If you take the case of the Tamil Tigers, the LTT in Sri Lanka, with an intense long-term war, this was one option of reply. You look at the kamikaze pilots, you look at instances of suicide bombing in Iraq and Afghanistan. You mentioned earlier a quote from, I think it was Nick in the United States, about, you know, how does one stop them wanting to do us harm? The problem is, if you turn this thing entirely round and look at it from the point of view of people committed to suicide bombing, say, in Afghanistan or Iraq, from their view, they would say it's the United States doing them harm. And I think one has to understand, whatever the circumstances are, at root it is not just poverty and marginalization. You're much more likely to get suicide bombing when there is something added, some direct occupation, some direct conflict, or something which actually heightens the circumstances.
Well, Paul, you mentioned Sri Lanka. Let's bring in Charnika, who's with us live from Kandy in Sri Lanka. Charnika, Sri Lanka, as Paul's just been detailing, has a long history of suicide bombings. Yes. Your government took the military approach to stopping it. Did you think that was the best way to deal with the situation?
Well, I'm against war, but somehow I'm really, really happy that these suicide attacks are finally over.
And so, as such, do you approve of the military action which was taken in the north?
Yes.
And Shaka, this is interesting. You're in Harvard. This is a specific example where people could go, well, actually, forget talking, forget understanding. If you take a military approach, you can sort these issues out.
Well, of course, Sri Lanka was a specific case where a military option was feasible, because there was a geographic element to the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers, and once those geographic strongholds were taken over by the government, you could essentially end the movement. That's not the case with many terrorist organizations that are transnational, whose aims indeed are actually not nationalistic. They're not aiming to liberate a country or to defend a particular country, although that certainly explains many examples of suicide terrorism. I think we have many examples today where you have people dying in the service of transnational causes, or causes that transcend national boundaries. And so what works in Sri Lanka might not very well work elsewhere, obviously.
Could I add, I think that in the case of Sri Lanka, it is certainly true that at the moment the military option seemed to have worked when many others failed. But I think we've got to wait 10 or 20 years to see whether that works. It's going to depend hugely on whether post-conflict peace building and reconciliation can be worked at very hard. Otherwise, I think there could be a very real risk that sometime in the next decade or two, another group will arise from within the Tamil community with more suicide bombings.
And I'd be curious to talk about that military option with reference to Afghanistan and Pakistan after the news, which is coming up in a couple of moments' time. We'll keep on talking with Paul Rogers, Asad Jirani, Shankar Vandatam, and Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj after a couple of minutes from the BBC Newsroom.